Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the health care they need. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. Today on our show, we explore the challenges of finding health care and child care in the Valley. And we provide some more details on Fresno State's nursing school. It's facing setbacks related to the accreditation of two of its programs. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Carrie Klein. We also speak with the Fresno-based filmmakers responsible for two short films gaining national attention, and we escape the heat by taking you somewhere cool.
But first, a recap of this week's news. Another priest in the Diocese of Fresno has been accused of sexual abuse. On Monday, 52-year-old Sylvia Gomez-Ray spoke out about the alleged abuse she said happened when she was a teenager working as a church secretary at St. Joseph's in Bakersfield.
Nobody really took me seriously in the 80s. They didn't believe me, adults that I went to. And so I kind of just said, forget it. You know, if I'm getting this kind of response from them, there's no way I can go up against this figure who is larger than life.
The priest in the allegation, Monsignor John Esquivel, works at St. Anthony of Padua Catholic Church in Reedley and has been put on administrative leave. The Fresno Diocese said it only learned about the allegation Monday and subsequently reported it to the Bakersfield police.
Turning to law enforcement, Fresno police arrested a man who admitted to making threats against the Fab nightclub in Fresno's Tower District. 28-year-old Jose Lechuga used a fake Facebook account and likened Fab to Pulse, an LGBTQ club in Florida where a gunman killed 49 people 3 years ago. Multiple guns and ammunition that Lechuga obtained legally were found in his car and home after the arrest. Here's Police Chief Jerry Dyer.
Lechuga certainly had the capability of carrying out this threat. Whether he would have done so is unknown.
Also, law enforcement in Kings and Tulare counties arrested 54 gang members this week. The crackdown was conducted through a 5-month multi-agency operation targeting Norteño and Nuestra Familia gang members. In a press conference Wednesday, Kings County law enforcement leaders said they seized 36 pounds of drugs and 53 firearms.
And yesterday, the Fresno City Council passed a motion to set aside $200,000 from the budget for an unconventional gun violence prevention program called Advance Peace. The 18-month fellowship program works with people who are most likely to be or already are involved in gun violence. They receive mentoring, behavioral therapy, life skills training, internships, and a stipend. The founder of the program, Devon Bogan, says Advance Peace is working in Richmond, California.
94% of our fellows are alive today. 83% of them haven't been injured by a firearm today. And 77% of those individuals have not been named as a suspect in a new firearm crime since becoming a fellow.
Fresno County is once again the site of an experimental mosquito control program called Debug Fresno. It works by releasing male mosquitoes that are infected with a bacteria, so when they mate with females, their eggs don't hatch. It specifically targets one mosquito species that's known to transmit tropical diseases. Steve Mulligan, who leads the local Consolidated Mosquito Abatement District, says last season was a success.
We had a 95% reduction over the course of the season. So we're very happy with those results.
And speaking of mosquitoes, West Nile virus has been detected in mosquitoes in 6 California counties so far this year, including Fresno and Tulare.
And finally, Fresno-based tech company Bitwise just secured $27 million in Series A startup funding. The company says the funding represents one of the largest Series A ever raised by a Latinx female-led company. The funding means Bitwise can build a second campus in Bakersfield and continue one of its missions to teach coding skills to people from marginalized communities.
Listen for more FM 89 news every weekday during Morning Edition and All Things Considered. Today is summer solstice, the longest day of the year. And summer days in general can feel really long for parents of young children, especially when they can't find adequate childcare. FM89's Monica Velez tells us some reasons why many San Joaquin Valley communities are childcare deserts and what one local university is doing to buck that trend.
Preschoolers play with a robot in the hallway outside of their classroom. They chase it and laugh as it rolls down the long corridor. Most of the parents of these kids are students at Fresno State. Brittany Randolph is the program director for the Huggins Early Education Center. She says offering care for students on campus is extremely important.
We had a parent say her GPA was so low before she was able to find care for her child because not every professor is going to allow you to bring the child to class because it can be a distraction. And once they find secure child care, it's easier for them to be successful in their classes.
Not every student with a child gets in. On average, 200 a year get into the center. Randolph says for most it's free, and that can make a huge financial difference in someone's life. Several studies point to many communities in the San Joaquin Valley as childcare deserts. Dr. Ping Wu is an early childhood education professor and the chair of the Huggins Center. She says it's especially hard for parents with infants and toddlers to find childcare because most teachers prefer to work with older kids for various reasons.
And one of them is definitely the compensation for early childhood professionals. I would say that a lot of our teachers are underpaid, and the society does not treat them as they need to be treated.
Parents who get their children in the Huggins Center are among the luckiest. But for many parents, childcare is more complicated.
This is Mikey. Say hi.
Hi.
And that's Tomas. I'm just trying to get their shoes, and I just got mine on. I'll start loading them up, but I have to find my purse. Right.
That's Cindy Alejandrez. She's a teacher and a single mom with two kids. Mikey is 3 and Tomas is 2. She lives in Merced, and on this day, she has a chiropractor appointment. She doesn't have daycare in the summer, so she's taking them with her. Not ideal for someone with a bad back.
They're going to adjust my back, and then I'm probably going to have to pick one of them up. And, you know, and then it's like, why did I even go to the chiropractor? But then I can't miss the appointment. I tried asking.
This is not unusual. Alejandra says her kids go with her everywhere most days. She says she's lucky this chiropractor didn't mind her kids being there. Not all places are welcoming to children. She says sometimes she feels embarrassed or judged.
I've gotten to like places where people seem to get upset that I bring my kids. So, Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, yeah. If you ever try to, yeah, like going to, yeah, like public office buildings, other parent places. Like, you can tell when places are meant for kids and not. Like, this place, they were very kind. There were no kids' toys. Hold on. Tommy, come here.
Alejandra says she wishes her kids could be at home, where they are comfortable and have space to run around. She says her life revolves around finding childcare for them.
It sucks, but that's kind of a plain word to put it. But, yeah, it's kind of, you know, it just kind of sucks. That's what I have to do.
But one university in her town, UC Merced, is working to improve childcare options. It recently partnered with Chowchilla High School to create an extension program. Kevin Reamer is a developmental psychologist at UC Merced. He created the curriculum, which is focused on child development.
We put that together to address where the issues that are most acute, which is the entry level. Those entry level childcare workers are extremely hard to find.
Juniors and seniors at Chowchilla High School can take a year-long class that's broken up into 4 college courses. This is the first school in the Valley to pilot the program.
By bringing the UC to a place like Chowchilla High, we're kind of trying to break down that fear of the unknown, particularly for first-generation Latinx learners who wouldn't ordinarily be thinking about college necessarily if, again, their family, you know, isn't oriented toward those kinds of post-graduation options.
By the end of the class, students have 12 transferable college units, and if they complete volunteer hours, they can apply for an early childhood associate teacher permit. And after that, they qualify to work in a daycare with infants to 5-year-olds.
Maybe to get high school kids thinking about not only college aspirations, but what would it mean if I were to come back to Chowchilla with a degree from Stan State in child development and start my own daycare. You know, planting those seeds is a really significant privilege with high school kids because they're open. You never know where they're going to go and how that may come back.
And at least one junior who was in the program this year wants to work with moms and infants. Jalen Richmond wants to be a midwife or a nurse practitioner. And until she goes off to college, she plans to get a job at a preschool thanks to what she's learned so far.
Especially the prenatal care in the beginning, and then the learning about pregnancy from when it starts to all the way when you give birth, and learning how that happens and how female body changes.
And she even had to create her own lesson plan and teach it to a class of kids.
I thought teachers had it so easy, like they just have to plan stuff out. Not even like that. I stressed when I had to create my lesson plan because you really got to work with them. You really got to think like they think.
This program is also expected to be implemented at Orisima High in Newman, Mariposa High, Golden Valley High in Merced, and La Grande High. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez.
People don't typically think of California as a particularly religious place, but maybe we should. We've got more megachurches than any other state. Pentecostalism was born here. And today, one small California city has become an unlikely global epicenter of Christian culture. As part of the California Dream Collaboration, KQED's Vanessa Roncagno reports.
Redding, California is the kind of place you learn your way around in a day or two. Downtown is just a handful of blocks. But walking around this city of 90,000, you can meet people from a dozen countries in a day.
From Australia.
From the Netherlands.
New Zealand.
I'm from England.
Manchester.
They're not here for the fly fishing or the views of Mount Shasta. No.
God is what brought me to Redding, California.
Specifically, God brought Galibe Omenaka to the Bethel School of Supernatural Ministry.
You are called to shape history.
The flawlessly produced promo video for the school shows people, mostly young, hip-looking people, raising their arms in worship while a band plays on stage. They place their hands on a forehead, a shoulder, a knee. A man hands over his crutches and walks freely.
Will you say yes?
We are a supernatural school, so we believe that healing is for today.
Leslie Crandall oversees first-year students at the School of Supernatural Ministry, where students are taught through prayer they can manifest the power of God to heal.
We believe that God is still speaking, and he can speak to his kids, and he does.
The school was founded 21 years ago by a pastor who heads up Bethel Church. It started with a few dozen local students. Today, the school's 2,500 students represent more than 70 countries. It enrolls more international vocational students than any other school in the country. On a Monday morning, 1,200 first years file into class.
Anoint our time together in the name of Jesus. Amen.
The students are studying worship music.
You got homework due on Wednesday. Yes, indeed.
Galibe Omenaka was still in England when he encountered Bethel's teaching at his church in Manchester. At first, he wasn't feeling the whole miracle thing.
My internal response was, this is the stupidest thing I've ever heard of in my life.
But then,
when you pray for someone, a complete stranger on the streets, and they get healed of a leg injury, and they say, what the heck have you done to me? It kind of changes the way you look at things.
Bethel wants to be more than a school with international pull, more than a megachurch with 11,000 members. Richard Florey is a University of Southern California sociologist who studied Bethel and says their objective is nothing short of cultural transformation.
Let's get the right kinds of Christians in the right kind of public sectors of American society, politics, economics, Hollywood, whatever, through their efforts will bring about the kingdom of God on earth in the here and now.
But some Redding residents don't want to be part of the experiment.
Redding is their test case of turning a city that is a democracy into a theocracy.
Laura Hammonds is a member of Investigating Bethel, a Facebook group with more than 1,000 members. Hammonds is one of a dozen members of the group meeting at a Redding park one afternoon. Another member, Donna Zeebel, is passing out stickers. Some say, don't drink the Kool-Aid.
We've handed them out, you know, just freely because, you know, we want to get the message out there. Some people are afraid to put them on their car.
Afraid, she says, because the church's influence feels like it runs through the core of the city. Redding's mayor is a Bethel elder. Bethel paid the salaries of several police officers when the city couldn't afford to. Bethel's influence was central to getting a direct flight from LAX to Redding. and there's a $150 million Bethel expansion underway that will triple church capacity and allow the school to grow by 1,000 students.
They have this really well-organized program to innervate everything with their influence.
David Boone, another member of Investigating Bethel.
You get this feeling that they know they're a sort of virus, but they think they're the good virus that we all need.
For some in Reading, the very integrity of their city is at stake. Others see Bethel as a positive force. They say it makes the city more vibrant, diverse. It's good for the economy. Either way, Bethel's outsized influence on this little city is unavoidable. Reading has become a new type of Christian Mecca. In Reading, I'm Vanessa Rancagno.
Maybe you've heard about the case Juliana versus the United States, in which 21 young people are suing the federal government for not protecting their right to a safe and livable climate. Well, young people all over are taking a stand against climate change. Last week, three Valley teenagers were in Washington, D.C. with the grassroots organization Citizens Climate Lobby. They lobbied their representatives to co-sponsor a bipartisan bill that would charge fossil fuel companies a tax for their carbon dioxide emissions. It's called the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. I caught up with Paulina Torres, Gerline Panu, and Emily Salazar just outside the Capitol building. The interview starts with Emily. What is it that, I guess, struck your interest enough to get involved, being a very busy high school student?
That the current solutions aren't as big as the current problem. They're not to scale right now, and we are already feeling it, especially in the Central Valley. We feel a lot of the effects that, you know, some of our representatives may not feel as much as we do. You know, I live in South Fresno, and we're heavily impacted by the pollution in the area. That's something our Congress member may not be able to feel.
So tell me a little bit more about that. What kinds of effects have you experienced, or have, I guess, people in your community experienced in terms of climate change?
Well, you know, actually, a common misconception is that, you know, why aren't more Latinos part of the climate action movement? And, you know, that is a bigger problem. But I think most of the Latinos that I've come in contact with and that I'm around agree that it's a problem. And since, I am in the Central Valley, a lot of people I know work in the fields, a lot of Latinos I know, and that has its own health consequences, which is connected to climate change. Yeah.
Can you give me some examples?
Well, like the drought, how it affects how much production we have, and then it affects the jobs.
And you're getting ready to go to Stanford. What are you going to study?
I plan to study psychology and Arabic as a pre-law student.
And as a lawyer, do you want to work on climate change?
Actually, my goal is to become a political representative, so I want to come back to the Valley and help protect the communities that supported me.
Gerline, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Fresno, California.
You go to Fresno City College, and you went to Central High School. Tell me what got you interested in climate change.
It was just growing up and witnessing bad air quality. I was in track in elementary school and middle school, and I remember how difficult it was to come out on those days and practice. I grew up with asthma, and luckily I grew out of my asthma, but that isn't the case for everyone. And I just want to be here as a representative and also for myself, for like a better climate.
Tell me, what are you doing today? You're getting ready to head over and talk to some representatives from the Central Valley?
So I'm going to be lobbying and for my representative, Jim Costa, and I'm going to be attending a meeting for Devin Nunes. And I'm going to be here to talk about my student government campaign. Fresno City College's student government endorsed the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. It's a bill that places a fee on carbon, and it's bipartisan. So it means both the left and the right are able to agree on it.
Paulina, tell me why you're here today. You grew up in Tarabella.
So my community is very low income, mostly farm laborers. My parents have worked in the fields since they were very young. They immigrated to the United States to provide a better life for my brother and I. And seeing my parents get up at, you know, 4 a.m. in the morning, come home at 5 p.m., and seeing them talk about heat strokes and things that aren't supposed to be common as something that is just normal kind of shook me. And aside from that, my community, they're very hardworking people, but they don't necessarily have the knowledge because most of them did not finish high school. Most of them are only Spanish speaking, not very educated. And being here allows me to be their advocate, allows me to represent Tarabella, to represent California, my family, my last name, everything.
What is it about climate change that inspires you to get out there and do something?
Well, the fact that it's our future. As an athlete, as a daughter of immigrants, as even a, you know, have a sibling, everything about climate change impacts me. As an athlete, you know, I love to run, I love to play soccer, I love to stay active, and not having that option, you know, it's just upsetting. Something that it should be natural, you know, for kids to go outside, to go swimming, to go have a run, to be healthy, for farm laborers to be able to work in, you know, places where they're not going to be getting heat strokes or, you know, those type of things are what I'm fighting for. And, you know, I think it's very important.
Tell me, what have you been doing this week?
This week, basically, I have been learning. This is my first conference ever, so I'm definitely in the process of learning, taking, you know, networking with other students, other professionals, and really getting ready for the main event, which is lobbying.
And where are you in school?
I will be attending UCLA in the fall as a freshman, and I will be majoring in political science with a minor in Chicano studies at the moment. I want to possibly maybe pursue law school, come back to the Valley, help out my community in various ways, maybe even be a political campaign like organizer. I love to do that. You know, like I said, I love to speak to people, canvas, everything. So that would be the dream.
Thank you for speaking with us today.
No problem. My pleasure.
Fresno State this week announced that one of its nursing programs, the Master's of Science in Nursing, has lost its accreditation. It's the first Fresno State program that's ever had its accreditation withdrawn, but it's actually the second accreditation-related snafu to hit the department in the last year. Here to translate what this means is my co-host and FM89 health reporter, Carrie Klein. So, Carrie, what exactly happened with this nursing master's program?
So, just a few weeks ago, this department was notified that it lost its accreditation. Now, this is not the entire nursing school. It's just the master's program. So, nothing has changed with the bachelor's degree, doctorate, or other programs offered by the nursing school. And it doesn't mean that the program can't operate, but it means that the program is out of compliance with federal standards until it can regain that accreditation.
How did this happen?
So it doesn't appear to be any failing of the quality of the program, but instead with documentation. According to the university, the program failed to properly document how it evaluates its students, faculty, and department standards. And so I spoke about this with Jody Hironaka-Juto, who is the dean of the College of Health and Human Services.
The decision by the accrediting body was a surprise to us. Over time, we felt that we were being responsive to the accreditation process, which is a customary process in higher education. And so what it means is that we're working diligently to regain that. We're really committed to make it right for our students.
She said this is an isolated incident, and it's helped to reveal shortcomings of the program.
So who accredits nursing programs, and what does that agency have to say?
So it's an accrediting agency known as the Commission on Collegiate Nursing Education. And I exchanged emails with the executive director, Jennifer Butlin. She didn't provide very much information, but in a statement, you know, she confirmed that the program lost its accreditation effective May 23rd. She did say the school had the opportunity to appeal the decision and hasn't yet. But also she confirmed that the commission has scheduled a site visit in September to evaluate this and a few other nursing programs looking to renew their accreditation.
Well, I would imagine that students in the program are feeling very insecure right now. What does this mean for those who are currently enrolled or even for past graduates?
So for past graduates, this really doesn't mean anything. Their degrees are safe. Those degrees were awarded while the program was still accredited. However, there are 23 students currently enrolled. They just finished their first year, about to start their second. If the program gets reaccredited next year, that will apply retroactively to their degrees. But if not, Hironaka-Juto Cho says they'll do their best to look out for those students.
Should that happen, we will work in conjunction with our accrediting body and our School of Nursing and our Chancellor's Office to provide pathways to support students' successful completion of their degrees.
And this is actually the second accreditation-related setback for the department this year. Tell us more about what happened back in September.
So one of the nursing school's certificate programs, the Psychiatric Mental Health Nurse Practitioner Program, was informed last fall that it had been operating without accreditation for years. This actually only made it public this last spring, however. And this one did affect former graduates, and it was a different situation there. According to Jennifer Butlin of this accrediting agency, certificate programs like that didn't actually need to be accredited for many years until there was a change in policy in 2014. And then apparently that's where there were some administrative errors, some communication mishaps, and that meant the program just never attained the accreditation that it needed after that policy change. And so that certificate program for nurse practitioners will also be reviewed during that site visit in the fall.
Wow, so two big blows. Does this reflect a lack of management or leadership within the nursing school?
You know, I pressed Dean Hironaka Juto on this, and, you know, I also asked her whether it'll result in any staff changes, and she really wouldn't say. She said it's the university provost who makes decisions like that and, you know, really evaluates faculty performance.
And, you know, we hear the word accreditation all the time. It sounds so important, but how much does it really matter?
That's actually a really interesting question, because it turns out educational institutions can actually operate without accreditation, and people can graduate and get those degrees, but the graduates run the risk of not being able to work in an official capacity. Some agencies and employers will actually hire nurses, doctors, other providers who graduated from an unaccredited program. That can happen. But those kinds of jobs are few and far between. It's likely that patients aren't informed. And those grads might have difficulty getting grants and other opportunities later on from, you know, federal agencies and government agencies. And also accredited grads will tend to have an edge over non-accredited grads. So it's just advised in general, get your degree from an accredited program.
And as you know, we're living in an area of intense shortages of doctors and other medical providers. If Fresno State can't regain accreditation, what would it mean to lose both of these programs?
Well, the good news is that we wouldn't actually be losing nurses here in this area. These programs are both advanced degrees. So all the students who enroll in them already are nurses, and they're simply enrolling in these to maybe work on research or get further certifications. On the other hand, of course, we want nurses to be able to advance and do this further work that they want to do. And graduates of the Psychiatric Mental Health Nurse Practitioner Certificate Program in particular are filling in a big gap in the Valley. You know, when patients come to see nurse practitioners in primary care roles, graduates with that certificate, they can better help connect them with psychiatric care if they need it, and that's not always available otherwise in those primary care settings.
So there's a site visit in September. What's next?
So the commission will review these programs and a few others in the nursing school as part of a routine review, and then they'll announce their decision in May of 2020.
Okay, great. Thanks, Carrie.
Thanks, Alice. When it comes to healthcare, the San Joaquin Valley is chronically short on providers, especially in rural areas, partially thanks to hospital closures, which have left communities like Dos Palos, Kingsburg, and Corcoran without access to adequate medical services. And for many residents of rural communities, transportation, cost, and language barriers keep them from receiving the healthcare they need. Kathleen Schock speaks with Dr. Amit Saini of Kaiser Permanente Northern California about efforts to bring healthcare services back to rural communities.
I'd love to start with talking about the scope of this issue. How far are you seeing people traveling just to get access to medical care? And can you give us some sense of this, how many communities are impacted?
In Central Valley, because we have such a large geographic area and not major hubs or city where you have access to care at a short distance, people tend to travel a lot. We see the impact in especially Kaiser Permanente's Selma Clinic. Our patients travel from Visalia, sometimes Dinuba, and they come in for a visit. Thankfully, we do have the pharmacy and access over there. And if Selma Clinic was not there, then their next choice was to come to Kaiser Permanente in Fresno. So people tend to travel sometimes 50 or more miles, especially if the situation is urgent, because then the need is driving you to come.
And I understand that there's many people who have the desire to make that travel in order to get the care that they need, but may not have the means to do that.
In our clinic, many times we make call to our patients because we are very heavy set on preventative care. And we like patients to come in sometime for blood pressure check, sometime to get the blood test done. Sometime we hear a barrier that there is one car in the family. And if that car is gone to work, then people do not have means to come, which is a big limiting factor.
So you spoke about preventative care. What are the kinds of health issues that emerge when you're dealing with populations of people who don't have easy access to medical care?
You know, most of the silent chronic conditions could be missed. I give an example, high blood pressure. Blood pressure is measured when you have a cuff around your arm and someone takes a blood pressure and tell you it is high. Otherwise, it is, in medical term, called asymptomatic, means I don't know if I have high blood pressure. So until I see a physician or a healthcare provider for periodic checkup, I would not know if I have high blood pressure. Untreated high blood pressure becomes a big health risk factor. It has four target organs. It can cause stroke, blindness, heart attack, kidney failure. The other conditions could be blood glucose, diabetes. It could be high cholesterol. These are all silent. So I'm not identifying a need to go to the doctor. If I have asthma, I'm short of breath. Of course, I will have a need to go to a healthcare provider and I'll seek attention. But if the condition is living in me and it's silent, I may not have motivation to get attention to that.
And then at the event that it becomes an emergency, if you're somewhere where you have to travel long distances in order to go to an emergency room, you're looking at the combined cost of both the visit and a long ambulance ride in order to get there, I would imagine.
Yes. And in addition to these two, economic impact and time factor, there is a health impact. Because if I'm having a heart attack and if I'm having a stroke, there's a clock ticking. Because if I come to emergency room in a timely manner, then the team of my care provider can give me the blood thinning medication that can revert.
So I understand Kaiser Permanente is funding several initiatives that are helping to meet the needs of these communities by taking medical care on the road, quite literally. Tell us a little bit about some of these initiatives.
Yes, our team is dedicated to serve our community in an effective way. And I feel that we are doing a lot of effort, but we need more effort across the board. It does not matter Kaiser Permanente. All healthcare organizations should get together to put more effort to provide health to our communities who are living far out than the hubs where the hospitals are. Last year, we have funded Healthy Smiles Dental Mobile Unit. We funded $540,000. This unit is operational since October last year. And this unit is equipped to provide dental care to children, doing cleaning, filling up of the caries, extraction of the teeth. And this clinic is also traveling all across the valley. The hope is that they will be able to provide care for up to 8,000 patients in a year. Another example is we provide funding to Buddhist Suu Kyi Foundation. And with this funding, they purchased, again, a mobile dental unit. We also provided $80,000 for a mobile unit, which is equipped with eye exams. So combined, they can provide dental care, eye exams to the patients. This unit is going to be operational November this year. The third example is Camarena Health. And Camarena Health mobile unit is to provide dental care and health care and behavioral health care to our patients in Madera County. And this unit is going to be operational in October. And this clinic we funded close to $550,000.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Kaiser Permanente's Dr. Amit Saini, who is the assistant physician in chief for access, service, and health promotion. You know, we're talking about some mobile medical services that Kaiser Permanente helps to fund throughout the valley. And I'm wondering what kind of reaction you hear. I know you're not personally out in the field, but I'm sure you're very deeply involved in this work. It must be incredibly rewarding the reaction that you get from these communities?
So I do volunteer occasionally. I'm using the word occasionally because I could volunteer more at our Buddhist Suu Kyi Foundation. And I have seen effectiveness there of their mobile vision van. Not only they were able to do the vision check, they were able to give glasses within minutes to people. I don't have words to describe when someone who has difficulty in seeing something and is able to see letter words and have a clear vision in minutes.
It must be extraordinarily rewarding. It just strikes me as we're talking, you hear about this kind of access issues in third world countries. You hear about, you know, doctors going in and providing glasses. It's amazing to me that we're seeing so much of that here in the Central Valley. I'm wondering if you could give your thoughts on how we got to this place. Why is there such a void in healthcare in so many communities?
In Central Valley, the geographic area is so broad that it's difficult to sustain a clinic in one particular area. You would not have enough patient to sustain for a healthcare provider. So hence, you tend to be located, which could be at a hub of maybe multiple small towns where people can come in, because you need to have patients to provide care also.
And I'm wondering, how do you determine where to go when the need is so great?
We have a focus, like Camarena Health is focused in Madera, so I know that is a focused intervention, and the entire community in Madera is going to benefit from that. It's slightly in contrast with the Healthy Smiles, because they go over almost 100 rural communities across the valley, but their frequency of visits may be lesser. These units could provide care, again, on routine or scheduled basis, but if there is an urgent situation or emergent situation, I doubt if we are able to serve someone who need it, unless it just is a perfect time that, you know, this is the day clinic is coming and this is the day I tend to fall ill.
So you mentioned earlier that the unit in Madera is also offering behavioral health. Can you speak a little bit more about what's being offered and why the need is so great?
How I define the indicators of health, the clinical factor is only 20%. There's a 10% indicator of the physical location of the area that is defined by air quality, water quality, your housing, and transit. Then comes your socioeconomic influence, and that is 40% affecting our health. And this starts from school education, followed by employment, followed by income, followed by family and support, or society and support, and safety. And then come health behavior, history of smoking, alcohol use, drug usage, sexual history, so forth and so on. And then come 20%, which is access and quality of care. So this 80% chunk has to be addressed. We cannot only focus on 20%. And that's where, again, the behavioral health come in. I'll talk about Fresno County. And Fresno County's per capita income is significantly lower when you compare with any of the Bay Area counties. That tells me that each family is bringing less money home. And there may be more folks than just a couple. So now I have less money and I have to provide for my kids' education. I need to buy food. I need to travel. And the cost of living is not going down. So I may have to do more than one job, or I may have to live dissatisfied. That means the baseline stress level goes up, and stress level grinding me over months and years is going to then feed in and instill depression and anxiety in me. And many times I could just simply stay quiet and live with it. Doesn't mean I don't have a need.
Right. Well, thank you so much for the work that you're doing. Thank you so much for being with us today, Dr. Saini.
Thank you.
Today in our studio, producer Cindy Wathen and filmmaker David Kennedy. Two of their recent films have been garnering all kinds of awards on the film festival circuit. Just last week, Best Experimental Film at the New York Shorts International Film Festival for their spoken word short film, Red Watch. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So you're both from Fresno. Give us a little history of how you got into filmmaking and how you started working together.
Well, I guess I'll go first. I went to the Roosevelt Performing Arts School in high school, and so I've always been involved in theater and photography. There wasn't really a filmmaking community here in Fresno, particularly in the 80s or even in the 90s, and even quite frankly, even now, really, not like you see in other cities. So I just kind of forced myself into it. I interned for every production company that did exist here, and then there would be movies that would, and television commercials that would come to town and shoot major motion pictures and commercials, and I would PA, which production assistant on those, when I was in high school.
So as a kid, you were interested in filmmaking.
Oh,
you
absolutely
knew what direction you were going. Totally. And what about you, Cindy?
Born and raised in Fresno. I went straight from grammar school to high school to college to law school, and then decided to change careers. And so I immediately moved to the Bay Area to work in book publishing, which I did for 10 years, and then came back to Fresno. And I have sort of always, well, I have always been involved in the arts. So this has been a transition for me to go from music to literature to film, which I think many people who have creative interests do. They like to explore. And as a producer, when you have both a law degree and a background in acquisitions like I did and other arts, it just made sense to transition into producing.
Now, let's turn to this spoken word short film, Red Watch. The actress and the writer in this film is Kyla Kennedy, your daughter, David.
No, sir.
And she's great. She's telling the story of a relationship using the Red Watch as a metaphor for its demise. So let's hear a clip.
I miss your stupid red watch. You know what? I do, because you don't wear it anymore. Now you're clad in two leather bands that meet to clutch onto what looks like a round compact mirror. And the way it glistens, you're not counting down the seconds until we're reunited. No. You are checking your reflection. Just catching a glimpse of your proud and worthy self, and nothing makes me tick more than the way you talk about change. I mean, it happens.
And of course, the new watch represents the boyfriend's more narcissistic self. How did this idea come about?
Well, I actually saw my daughter perform this at a open mic night at Cantor's in Los Angeles, famous Jewish deli. And I was immediately like, hey, we got to shoot this. This is cool. This is a great audition piece. She was at PCPA. This is a school for acting and theater. And she graduated from there. And she's at the Groundlings in Hollywood. And so I was like, hey, let's get not only headshots together, but we need a reel. So to me, I thought this would be just something great to shoot. So that's exactly what we did. We just kind of threw it together, shot it in one day. And,
so very organic, and yet it's winning
organic.
All these awards.
Yeah.
And we should let our listeners know how the film ends with another metaphor. She says she won't end up like his stupid red watch in a junk drawer in his nightstand when he outgrows her. Mm-hmm. So it's beautifully written. Another film is the mini-doc, The Blessing and the Curse, about local musician Lance Canales, who describes his music as blues with Central Valley grit. He's self-taught on the guitar, and in 2015, his album, also titled The Blessing and the Curse, debuted at number 5 on the Euro Americana charts. So let's play a clip of him.
We played this big festival last year, and it was Dwight Yoakam was there, and John Fogerty, and Chris Robinson from the Black Crows, and all these big, huge, rock stars. And I came out, after we got done, I came out of the gate, where the artists go, and I got mobbed and flew home on Sunday. Monday morning, I'm back at work, and I'm just looking at my day job. Wow, there's literally almost no God, because I'm over here on this stage with all these awesome people, and then I fly back home to the Central Valley, and I'm a janitor. I have a day job as a janitor.
So is that why it's called The Blessing and the Curse?
I believe so, yeah.
And how did you find Lance?
I was actually at a benefit for the San Joaquin River, and he performed. Cindy took me. And at that time, I thought to myself, I was doing a whole bunch of small documentaries on kind of famous Fresnans, people who don't necessarily live here anymore, but are doing amazing things in Hollywood and in the arts. And I said to myself, hey, we got to do something on this guy. And then what happened subsequently is about a year or so goes by, there is the Big Till event here in Fresno where they give out grants. And I said, well, why don't we apply for that and see if they would like, us to do it? And we won the grant. And that's how that came about.
And Cindy, you've been applying for all of these film festival awards. Tell us about that.
Yes. So when David produced Red Watch for his daughter to promote her acting career, the thought wasn't really to enter it in the festivals. But as David and I have progressed with doing more film in our lives, I immediately wanted to enter it into the festivals. And he just kind of nodded his head like, okay. But I really went at it. And so I thought, well, we haven't yet entered in Blessing and the Curse. It's a great time to enter both of them, get some experience with how they do and get to know the festivals a little better. And I think we've just been blown away by the success of this sort of this, you know, random decision to just put it out there, not overthink it. And it's just entered now in the beginning of the film festival circuit. So we're going to continue to get results probably through around February. But just right out of the gate, it's just been fascinating to hear the response, and to win in New York was just above and beyond our wildest imaginations.
So tell me, what is it like to be on the film festival circuit?
It's fun. Yeah, it's really cool because you get to see other films, which is really interesting. See what other people are doing, the trends that are happening, and you get to meet filmmakers. I think that's really, you know, living in the Valley, particularly Fresno, I feel like I live in kind of a bubble. There's not a lot of filmmakers and photographers here. So when I go to Los Angeles, I talk my friends' ears off. You know, I literally don't take a breath because I feel like I haven't talked to people. I lived in Los Angeles for 11 years and worked in Hollywood at DreamWorks and other places. And coming here, I just don't have anybody to talk to. Nobody to talk to shop with, really. So when you go to festivals, it's just fantastic, you know.
So as a filmmaker, what is it like being in Fresno, and why did you come back to Fresno?
Well, my father was dying of a disease, and so we moved back here. And then subsequently, my ex-wife and I started a magazine called Fresno Magazine. That existed for about 10 years and then went out of business. I was doing commercials for all the big players, Community Medical Center, you know, Table Mountain, Casino, all that, Godchalks, before they went bankrupt. It was good for a while, but it's difficult. For me, at least, I don't know, maybe for somebody else would feel different, but for me, it's extremely difficult to be a filmmaker in the Valley.
Well, I noticed that in Red Watch, the mm-hmm. scenes, the backdrop, they're all Fresno scenes, kind of iconic Fresno scenes, like the murals. Is Fresno an interesting place to shoot a film?
It is. It's more difficult, though, because you don't have the depth of production people that know what they're doing. If something breaks, you can't just call in and have somebody bring you a new camera in 10 minutes from down the street. So in a lot of ways, it's actually more difficult to shoot in Fresno than I think Los Angeles, New York, or any other city like that.
So the Lance Canales film, it's not quite 5 minutes long, but my guess is it took you months, maybe more than a year to put it together. Tell people about that, because I don't think people realize how much work it takes to just put something that relatively short together.
It took about 4 days to shoot from different various locations, but it took me off and on about 2 months to edit. So, yeah, I mean, I think probably if you compress time, you're looking at probably about a 6-week window of putting it together. But like you said, it's only five minutes. So if you were to do something longer, yeah, you can see that it could take over a year or so to make something.
And do you want to do a feature-length film together?
Absolutely. We have something, a script that I had originally sold to Miramax many years ago and got the rights back to, and it's something that I'm really would like to do soon.
What about you, Cindy?
I would love to, but it's interesting for me, you know, having changed arts, is that this is new to me. So to be able to do a feature film, we would have to bring on, you know, a much higher level producer, but I would love to work under them and learn. It would just be fascinating to get to go to that next level.
So you've made these great shorts. How can people see them?
Well, that's kind of the tricky thing right now, is a lot of the festivals require that they not be available online. And many of them, in fact, the bigger festivals require a premiere status. Sometimes that's world premiere, sometimes that's national premiere, sometimes it's West Coast or East Coast or even just their city. So we, like a lot of filmmakers, you'll read about this quite a bit now, they debate whether it's better to just put it up on YouTube or Vimeo and build an audience and then sell to distributors or buyers there, or go to the film festival circuits and get those accolades and then try to seek distribution. But all of that is to say they can't see it at the moment, but there is talks of being able to do a showing for the Fresno community at the Fresno Art Museum. So we'll see whether that comes to fruition, but if it does, we will certainly let everyone know this is your one opportunity to come into what's really kind of a semi-private showing and see it. But as far as online, you'll probably have to wait about 6 months.
I was going to add, we are going to do, we're not sure exactly when, but we are going to do another art hop. I'm an art photographer, so I'm going to have my art up on the wall. But she's right, we're going to have a underground screening that we're not going to really advertise, but it's like a club, you know. You have to have a password, and there's nothing on the door about it. But we will be screening both of those there.
That's great. It's been wonderful talking to you. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now it's time for the weekend. We're taking you straight up on Highway 180 to Giant Sequoia National Monument. There's the Kings River and the beautiful trees that give the monument its namesake. But there are also caves up here, lots of them. And while most aren't easily accessible, FM89's Laura Satsui brings us this audio postcard of one that just reopened to the public.
People have been touring Boyden Cavern for over 100 years now, ever since J. Putnam Boyden found it in 1906.
He actually lived inside the cave for 10 years. He would run tours for a nickel. And then because the times were so different back then, the word is that he would also allow people to take souvenirs from the cave, so breaking off formations if they were willing to pay a little bit extra.
That's Maria Baker. She and her husband, Daniel Baker, have been running tours at the cavern for the last month since it reopened. Unlike Boyden, they don't allow visitors to take souvenirs. The cave had been off limits since 2015, when the Rough Fire ripped through Kings Canyon. The fire destroyed two wooden bridges and cut off access to the cave. But the cavern itself was unharmed. Daniel Baker says the cave probably looks today like it did 100 years ago.
The cave never changes. I mean, it's in a constant state of change that can't really be measured in our lifetimes.
It's a quick, steep hike up to the mouth of the cave, and I'm already sweating.
All right, let's get started on a cave tour. Can I have the last...
Daniel leads a tour of 18 people. While the temperature outside is 80 degrees and climbing, it's always 55 degrees inside the cave. Stepping in, it's kind of like opening a refrigerator. The cool air envelops me. We even hear a cave creek running as we walk along.
So in this section of the cave, we can see some calcite formations. This one here is called a drapery. This one here is what we call a ribbon. But if you ask a caver what they call that, they might tell you it's called bacon.
When you shine a light on it, there are strips of color, like meat and fat. The path we're on was built by the Civilian Conservation Corps back in the 30s.
You can see our stalactites back there. We call that the upside down city. The ones that form on the ground are called stalagmites. And those might reach the ceiling. That being said, watch your step coming through here. And of course, watch your head. We're gonna round the corner into what we call the Headache Maker Hallway.
At the back of the cave, there's a waterfall. We wade through a freezing creek to get there. The water is from snowmelt. It'll be gone in a month, and so will the waterfall. But the cavern and its formations will remain a cool respite for those escaping the valley heat. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui at Boyden Cavern.
Boyden Cavern is open for tours 7 days a week, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. You can find tickets and more information at boydencavern.com.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook.
Don't forget to check out our app. It's called KVPR, and it's available for free on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by the KVPR news team. Alice Daniel, Monica Velez,
Laura Satsui, and Carrie Klein. Technical support from Marv Ellen and Don Weaver. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need. On the web at chcf.org.